The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Good morning to you. It is just turning 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 16th of February, 2024. You're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. Loads coming up over the next 3 hours. We're going to kick off in the first hour with our Friday panel discussing some of the big stories of the day and the week. And we want you to join in that conversation as well. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. Just a reminder for you that you can watch proceedings on your large screen smart TV on the YouTube app or on your Fire Stick. Just type in Highland Radio Ireland. That's good to go on your mobile devices as well. And we're on Facebook, Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport, and on X. All right, let's say hello to our guests this morning. And we'll say good morning first to Catherine Noon, lawyer and former Fine Gael senator. Good morning, Catherine. How are you getting on? Great to have you back on the show. Lovely to see you. Michael Harrison, retired Garda inspector. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Greg. How are you?
Very well indeed. And last but not least, Barbara O'Cahill, Cor Dehor, Planola Changa, Leanra Letrakenny. Good morning to you. How are you getting on?
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm trying to do more of the introduction to you in Irish rather than skirt around it, so you'll have to forgive me. But listen, it's the right thing to do. Okay, lots for us to discuss. I might start with RTE, if that's okay. It's a story, it's very, very important, but as I said to listeners a little earlier on in the week, I'm tiring of it a little bit, but that's irresponsible of me. I shouldn't be, because it's massive money and it needs to be resolved. Reading this morning that RTE paid out 2.6 million in golden handshakes to executives during Dee Forbes' reign as Director General. The broadcaster's accounts reveal the significant payments across 6 years to key management personnel receiving termination benefits. The revelation comes after it emerged a €450,000 exit package was given to former RTE Chief Financial Officer Brenda O'Keefe. Now, these aren't redundancies packages. These are sort of exit packages. And there is a tax liability, though. It's not significant in the wider scale of things. Catherine, I mean, it's obviously not going away, this controversy. Is this part, though, of the cleansing process, that we shouldn't be surprised of these revelations?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, well, what I've heard in commentary over the last couple of days is that really there was nothing illegal about this payment, much as it may sound like over the top to those of us listening. But, you know, the question is, I suppose, you know, that, well, the question that's being asked generally out there is, should she be giving the money back? And she may well decide to, but I think it would probably be a goodwill gesture on her part if she did, because it seems that there was nothing actually illegal about it, even though the, you know, the method that they went about maybe approving the payment wasn't correctly done internally. From her perspective, it's hard to see how, you know, if it were in court, how they would have a leg to stand on.
Is the scrutiny of these individuals justified, or is there a danger that it becomes a bit of a witch hunt, a bit of a head on a stick job?
There is a danger of that, because there was a general culture in RTE that permeated the whole organisation, especially at the top tier, say financially, wages wise. And it's very, I would imagine it's very difficult for an individual to be subjected to the level of scrutiny and, you know, discussion about their exit payment, which for all intents and purposes, if it were examined legally, is above board. You know, it appears, while they may not have observed what they should have observed internally in terms of, you know, proper authorities, you know, I don't think the woman has actually done anything wrong, and her name is all over the papers and all. We're talking about her this morning, and I'm sure they're talking about an RTE, you know, so it's a very difficult one on a personal level. And I think your point is very valid, Greg, about a witch hunt, you know.
Michael Harrison, do you think Breda O'Keefe has a moral obligation, as it's been framed, to pay back the €450,000? I mean, if you start there, where does it end? And I don't want to sound like I'm in any way defending this, but we had the same clause with Ryan Tobberty. Now, he's very well resourced and able to make an awful lot of money going forwards. I'm not sure what Breda O'Keefe, you know, she is in the public eye, but she's not a you know, a public person as such. Do you think the calls are justified? You're muted, Michael. Sorry, I beg your pardon.
Greg, as a result of just much the same as yourself, you know, I had kind of tired of the whole RTE saga and listening to it. And when I seen it was up for discussion today, I started, you know, to do some research. And when I did actually do my research, I thought, actually, I'm quite annoyed this morning about the whole thing.
Sorry.
You know, these guys have, you know, as a board, you know, the first thing board members have, and this isn't just something that's made up, this is something that's contained in the Companies Act 2014. They have a fiduciary duty, to look after everything and, you know, do things properly and honestly as board members. And under the Broadcasting Act, you know, the board have to represent the interests of the viewers. That's the first subsection that they have to do. And where, you know, there might be nothing illegal that they've done, but they certainly did not act within good faith in representing the people, the audience, the people of this country in what that board done. How they managed to, you know, come up with the figures that they've come up with. And even in, you know, today's Irish Independent, you know, there's more golden handshakes. And there was an article published on the in July on the RTE website outlining, you know, these were non-executive directors, and it is a lucrative gig for anybody who gets a non-executive director. They're employed on the basis of their skills, on their skill set, whatever that may be. But for whatever reason for leaving it, I cannot see how paying people this huge amount of money is acting in the good faith of the people of this country.
Is the hangover from this the reality that, and I think it's sort of some commentators are suggesting in the papers today, that the licence fee is dead in the water, that it can't, you know, when someone calculated yesterday 2,500 homes paying the licence fee for a year just to pay this exit package, right? Like the licence fee and how RTE is funded, it can't continue as is, surely, because
the whole governance, the method of which this organization is governed was completely wrong. You know, these guys were running it for the sake of themselves. You know, I remember watching when this scandal broke first, and there was a commentator on Sky News who worked in RTE. He said they couldn't even afford remote controls for the televisions in the newsroom. But yet these guys were getting paid huge handshakes. Like all it appears that they were doing is, from a governance point of view, was looking after themselves, which is just agency theory. It was completely wrong. And the license fee, as it stands from reading this last night, the whole board structure, the method of which this board was governed, it's just finished. It cannot continue.
Well, Kevin Backhurst is in there now to sort of, you know, to sweep things up, so to speak. I mean, can it be rehabilitated, given the ongoing revelations that we're hearing?
Well, if these massive handshakes to non-executive directors, who, whatever reason, are leaving, if that remains part of the rules and regulations of RTE, no.
Barbara, what's your view?
They're not representing us.
Yep.
Now, how is that value for money?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Barbara, what's your view?
Yeah, I think we need to be careful of presuming that the whole of RTE was rancid with this, because I think there's an awful lot of very good people who keep RTE going on a day-to-day basis. And they are the people who seem to be struggling on self-employed contracts. And they do not have any of these benefits. And they are under huge pressure. Their wages are not good. They don't have things like maternity cover and sick cover and all of those things. And so there's, you know, I would agree with Michael, there's been a complete imbalance.
And I would say, Barbara, to your point, I would imagine that some of the greatest anger is coming from within RTE, because, you know, you talk RTE, if you mention Highland Radio, it's all of us here, right? So even if it's one person, the brand is everyone sort of associated with it. So we talk about RTE, it is everyone. And I would say a lot of the people that you talk of that feel hard done by, they are feeling the pain the most on many, many of them on moderate wages.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think at the moment, if I was to say, oh, I work for RTE, there would be a presumption that somehow I'm on this gravy train. And for so many, I'd say the majority of people working in RTE, that is not the case. And so something has to change radically, where there is a level of respect for the people who actually keep the organisation going. And this attitude of, you know, payment packages being put through, not going to the executive, not getting proper approval. You know, yesterday we had Eimear Cusack, obviously uncomfortable with the level of payment that was being put through, But she didn't actually raise that with other management figures. So there was something very rotten in the whole system. Now, yes, Kevin Backhurst is in now. He wasn't there at that point. It's hard to see how he can turn this round. I think there has to be a huge change in things like the licence fee.
Well,
in
how
the whole
do you
culture.
Do that, though? Because, you know, at the end of the day, whilst we're talking about licence fee, more and more people aren't going to pay. Sinn Féin have effectively said that they will scrap the licence fee and fund RTE by direct funding. And then people are going, well, shall I bother paying it now? Because if I don't pay it now, even if I get a summons and there's a change of government, maybe there'll be an amnesty and I'll get away with it. So there's so much noise out there at the moment, like, that who is going to pay the licence fee? They really need to come up with a solution very, very quickly. And is that solution, Barbara, in your view, direct exchequer funding? Would you be comfortable with that?
Well, I think direct exchequer funding means it's coming out of our pockets.
Yeah.
It's not falling off trees. So I think if we have a sense that things have been turned round in RTE, but it's not just RTE, this needs to be broader than that. It's about funding of public service broadcasting right across the board. And from that perspective, yes, I think it should be something that is coming directly from the exchequer, from our taxes, but done in a way which maybe challenges RTE to look at to what extent they're fulfilling that mandate of public service broadcasting.
What is public
and supporting
service,
others that do?
Yeah, what's public service broadcasting to you, Michael? Because it said an awful lot, but, you know, there's an awful lot of people really aren't happy with the output from RTE. But what is, in your view, public service broadcasting?
Well, it is actually defined, Greg. The RTE board was set up in 1960. It was initially called the RTE Authority. And the duties of the board, you know, it is enshrined in the Broadcasting Act of 2009, and certainly the broadcasting is about delivering the best, you know, the best value for money TV, you know that you can get, you know, to the public for what they can see, and it, you know, that it is funded properly, that it received, that, you know, that it does receive adequate finance in it. You know, adequate financing, adequate resources, you know, so that we can get. And there is, like, all you have to do, like, I was watching that program that's on RTE on Sunday night, now, absolutely fantastic series. And there is some, RTE does some fantastic work. TG4 does some of the programs on TG4, I Fear Scale every week. And that is, you know, good public broadcasting, but it seems to have, you know, there's all you hear about and listen about is it can't afford. And obviously, what the board hasn't been doing, it hasn't been adhered to Section 87 of the Act. They haven't been represented the interest of the viewers and listeners. And that is in the legislation. And how paying up these massive payouts to board members represents the best interest of viewers and listeners, complies with the Broadcasting Act, I don't know.
And Catherine, just finally, before we take a break and move on, there is a seemingly an issue with accountability in this country. And I can see why people aren't surprised anymore by certain things, because be it in the health service, be it in, you know, broadcasting, and in many, many areas, like, people are disgusted by what's going on, how it went on. And as you quite rightly pointed out in your first contribution, no laws were broken. But for some, that's not simply enough. It's like, well, how can Dee Forbes okay stuff left, right and centre, and it to be okay that she can, and I hope she's well, but that she can not come before the Public Accounts Committee, not answer any questions. At the same time, some might say she's been thrown under a bus, that everything's being put on her, and so on and so forth. It comes back to the accountability in the sense in this country that really you can do whatever you like, and often the better resourced you are, the freer you are to do whatever you like.
Yeah, and it's where the book stops, isn't it? And I mean, she was the director general. The book should have stopped with her and the board. And just to go back to some of the things I said earlier, like, just for the avoidance of clarity on it, I totally agree with Michael. I mean, I wasn't for a second suggesting that the board had done their job well, or that it wasn't, like, I wasn't extremely annoyed. And we all have become a bit tired of it. But I was just making the point that legally, I felt that the gun was being pointed in the wrong direction if it's being pointed at her, because the executive board and the non-executive directors, you know, it's their responsibility. That's the point I was making. So I just wanted to clarify that. But there's a lot of fear in Leinster House with committees where they bring people in, and since the Angela Kearns experience. And, you know, I think there's a reluctance, you know, and the compellability issue is very real. And I think there's fear among civil servants that that could happen again if they came down heavier. And, you know, it's very, very frustrating. But there is no potential route to serious accountability here, as far as I can see.
Yeah. OK, listen, thank you very much indeed for that. You're listening to the voices of Catherine Noone, lawyer and former Fine Gael senator, Michael Harrison, retired Garda inspector, and Barbara Ucahill of Leinrite Letterkenny. All right. There's a road traffic collision that has occurred in the last wee while on the Lifford Road. It's on the Letterkenny side turning off to Raphoe. A number of motorists have contacted us to say, just to avoid, if possible, it's at the edge of Murlough Chapel, I'm being told. So hopefully everyone's okay there. But just if you are on the road, please be very careful. On a recent 6 o'clock show on Virgin Media Television, Ivan Yates was asked if he speaks Irish. When the show's host, Brian Dowling, and Fionnuala Jay interviewed native speaker Sheila Shoiga, Yates said, "I couldn't be arsed to learn Irish, and I'm sorry if you're offended." Dowling then got up from his seat and shook Yates' hand, adding that he too is no Irish. Yates continued, "All this money we put into it, there's only 16,000 people in the country speaking it now." He added that he's not against it, though. Was this a public showing of what many might feel, I wonder? Can the language be saved? Well, one person at the front of that battle to save and enhance and grow the language, of course, is Barbara Ucahill. What was your reaction to those views? And I suppose the reaction to those, to that programme, Barbara?
I think, you know, Ivan Yates likes to stir the pot. That is what he does. But the whole thing escalated. I think Brian Dowling's response to it was hugely problematic. But I think the follow-up to it as well was problematic, because the next day Brian Dowling laughed it off. Oh, you know, might have ruffled a few feathers. And then Ivan Yates doubled down on what he had said. And when there was a reaction to the whole item on the 6 o'clock show, and he got pushback on it, he described the people who raised those complaints as hateful people, absolute zealots and bullies. Now, it's interesting that he can give it out, but by God, he cannot take it. So whenever anybody pushes back against him, he becomes very defensive. I think it showed a huge lack of respect, not just for the Irish language, but for Sheila Shoiga as well. She was there as a guest. You know, when she began to speak in Irish, Brian Dowling piped up, "Oh, are we going to get subtitles?" And I think it's really sad. You know, I was reading some of the stuff that Sheila Shoiga said just afterwards, and she was saying, you know, she's just so bored with this conversation. And I think she's right. You know, it just gets a bit exhausting to listen to people giving off about the Irish language, when my experience in my role as coordinator of Plan Le Changi here in Letterkenny is that there's such a buzz, there's such energy about Irish. I mean, at the moment we have over 100 people doing Irish classes with us. Now, they have not been marched in to those classes and made to do them. These are people who want to do Irish. People who maybe did Irish in the past, people who are total beginners, some of whom have come from other countries, people who are quite fluent but want to improve the, you know, just the richness of their language. We have people who have additional needs, started a class in Donegal Horizon there the other day and are absolutely loving it. So there's a positivity about Irish that really clashes with what Ivan Yates is saying and with Brian Dowling's reaction. And I think it really gives us an insight into how deep that colonial mindset is, where we still think it's acceptable to see Irish as being of no value, of having no purpose. For so many people, Irish is a connection with our identity, with who we are, with where we are. You know, if you look, even look now in East Belfast, people in a staunchly loyalist community who are learning Irish because they've realised that their own identity is more complex and that Irishness is actually part of it and the Irish language is part of it. And so they are beginning to embrace the Irish language and learn it as well, because it gives them an access into that part of who they are.
Is it niche,
and even
though,
just the place names around them.
But Barbara, is it niche that it's kind of cool to learn Irish? Or for, you know, the numbers that you're talking about are fantastic, but modest, I suppose, in the wider scale of things. Is it mainstream, sort of the love of the language, the wish to learn it, even though people, not everybody can or is learning it? Or is it sort of a niche thing that people see as an interesting hobby?
No, I don't think it is just a niche thing. And I think, yes, there is a difference. Now, you know, Ivan Yates' figures, I'm not sure where he pulled those out of. In the census, there were 72,000 people, not the 16 that Ivan Yates mentioned, 72,000 people who were talking about speaking Irish on a daily basis outside of the education system. And there were over 195,000 who said that they had very good Irish. Now, again, yes, those figures are only small. We want them to be a lot bigger than that. But people's positivity towards Irish is infinitely higher than that. And we did some research recently. And, you know, we asked people how important it would be to them that there would be more Irish seen and heard around Letterkenny, and kind of out of five, and the average was 4.4.
Yeah.
Now, 64% of people were telling us, hey, absolutely, 5 out of 5. So even if they don't speak it, and that's something that we notice that, you know, even if I go into shops, I'm very inclined to, you know, throw in a few bits of Irish, and people will respond. So many people will respond. It might only be a phrase, or they might get into a conversation. But there is a sense of people are delighted to use the Irish.
I think, too, what people from outside of Ireland, people that come and visit Ireland, would be shocked that this conversation's even happening, if you know
exactly
what I mean. They'd be going, what? They can't imagine it would ever happen in Spain or France or Italy or whatever. Catherine, I mean, like, Ivan Yates is an antagonist. That's what he does. And part of his shtick on News Talk was to be anti-Donegal. So we're well used to him up here, right? And, you know, he's looking to drive listeners and ears to his podcast. So I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not giving him a pass on this, but I mean, he's kind of, I think really what he's done is pulled the curtain back maybe on a conversation and started a conversation. But, I mean, what's your take on the general chit-chat about the language that has come from this exchange?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, like you say, it's a conversation starter. It's exactly what you'd expect from Ivan. He's a man I know pretty well. And, you know, that's how he rolls. I've often been on his programme. As you say, he's provocative, and that's what he does. So I think Brian Dowling's reaction was kind of petty and just jumping on a little bandwagon. Or, you know, I didn't see the television show live, but I've read the commentary. You know, I just think it's a repeated circular conversation that happened over many decades. I mean, I'm personally proud of the Irish language. Do I speak it on even a monthly basis? No, I don't. I mean, I tune in. I don't turn off Nuach when it comes on, and I'd listen and make sure I still understand, you know, a large percentage of it. I went to the Gaeltacht when I was young. You know, I'm proud of the Irish language, and I probably fall into a category of people that Barbara describes as positive towards the language and can speak it okay. But, you know, it doesn't really affect the majority of people's daily lives. So whether we like it or not, Ivan is tapping into a sentiment that some people do.
So should we continue to fund and encourage its growth? Quite a bit of money goes into you know, promoting and trying to grow the Irish.
It's part of our heritage, and you know, it's our language. And I think the fact that 195,000 people speak it very well, given the difficult environment, for want of a better phrase, for those who wish to speak Irish, in the sense that most people don't. So, mind you, every company you call on the phone, they do give you the option to speak to them through Irish. I often wonder, if you did press 7 for Irish, would you actually get to speak to somebody in Irish? But no, I mean, we do need to resource our heritage and the Irish language. You know, it's part of our lived heritage. You know, it's not, we're not talking about history here. It's it's daily life for some people. So in the context of stuff we spend money on, I don't think it's unreasonable to spend money on the Irish language.
Michael Harrison.
No, I don't disagree with any of the last two. It's an embarrassment, like, the level of Irish, that we do speak. Speaking for myself, on an individual level, learned at a school, and whatever reason, you get into a certain stage of your adulthood and you lose interest in it. And then, I do Spanish twice a week, and I love learning Spanish. I was at the Spanish class last week, and like Barbara was saying there was a lady there who's in the class who's not from the, traditional Irish background, in over 60, who started learning Irish in Derry. And she absolutely loves it. I was completely embarrassed. I said, what is this? And, you think back, this is our culture. This is who we are. We are, we are Irish, and Irish is our language. And it would be an absolute embarrassment for us to lose it, to let it go into decline. And we must do everything possible to encourage just a simple speaking of it. And it's something that I have been looking at, just to find out, where you can go into a class and there you just speak it. I'll be in touch with you. Barbara, I see you, and I definitely will be in touch with you, because it is something, as I said, I've learned Spanish from scratch. I now can go into a pub and ask for a Heineken Zero. I don't know if I could do it in West Donegal. Okay. That's the truth. That's the difference in, how my Irish has although I think just actually came to my head, I think it actually could. it is there, and it is just waking it up. It is there, it's just waking it up. But, it is our culture. It's who we are.
Is this part of the problem in how we phrase it and have the conversation about retaining our culture? Because an awful lot of the conversation at the moment, I'm not going to stray into that really, is some would say that kind of language is being used in context or being misappropriated. I just wonder if we struggle really to be an open, welcoming country, but also actually promote and enhance the culture, so to speak. I'm not phrasing that fantastically, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. I do.
And I think there is no conflict between being an open and welcoming culture and celebrating who we are. I don't think there's any conflict there at all. And I think that's reflected in the fact that even here, we have people who are Indian, who are Polish, who are American, who are, Filipino, from whatever background, who are now learning the Irish language because they want to be part of that and they want to be able to speak the language. I was speaking to a gentleman who is from Nigeria who was saying to me he has been learning Irish, and it was when he began to learn the language that he encountered the soul of the country. That so much of who we are is tied up in our language. Mm-hmm. The Irish language has incredible depth and beauty, and it does give us a sense of who we are. I mean, even just look at the place names around you. If you don't have Irish to understand where they're coming from, most of them are gobbledygook because they're transliterations. They're English forced onto what's actually an Irish name. So even our sense of place is rooted. And I mean, we would have a lot of people who come from other countries who will express that disbelief. Why is there not more Irish spoken here?
Yeah.
Do they want to encounter it?
Why I was trying to sort of suggest if it's a wider thing. Even talking about our history or certain events or how we frame the famine or whatever it might be, sometimes we're very careful with how we describe it, or we're almost apologetic, or we don't really want to talk about it. And I'm just wondering if this is, things that happened 100, 200, 300, 400 years ago are still shaping how we think as a nation and as a people now.
Absolutely.
It doesn't just go away in a generation. It's... No.
And that's why I'm talking about this need to decolonize our minds. If you asked many people who will give off about Irish and it's of no value and we shouldn't learn it, we should get rid of it. And if you said to them, okay, would you put on an England rugby shirt for when Ireland are playing England in the Six Nations? And they'd be horrified.
I think Ivan would say yes,
maybe he would, just to wind people up. Yes. But what I'm saying is that linguistically, that's what they're prepared to do.
Yeah.
And it is that level at which the impact of colonization, if you're going to colonize a people, take away their language, because then they don't know who they are.
exactly.
So there's a recapturing of the Irish language. And it's not done in an aggressive way, but it is done in an assertive and a proud way to say, this is core to who we are, and we're more than happy to share this with other people and to celebrate this language and to have a real sense of the importance of language and of minority languages and to reach
I just
out
think,
to other people.
I think we should, regardless of what I think, but it shouldn't really matter what I think, but anyway, I just think we should get past, I think it should be accepted, right, that Irish language is the you know, the language of Ireland, that it is important, and that any country should try and retain its language, its history, its accepted.
That should be
and
a
then
given.
That's the given. Yeah. And then from there we start to, how do we get to use it? How does it become more relevant? Rather saying, well, should we just use the English that we have because they gave it to us?
And that's don't forget how handy it is to have Irish when you're abroad or you're in a taxi abroad and you want to say something to one of your family members, and you can say it in Irish. You know, I've done that so many times over the years, and you can be, it happened to a friend of mine that she was chatting away about something in Irish, and then an Irish fella got up on the train beside her and said, Slánanish, you know.
Michael's just in the back of the taxi randomly ordering Heineken 00, I think. Okay, so
Brian Friel's translations is well worth reading. It's a very small play, but it's very well worth reading from the point of view of the point that that Barbara was making about place names. And it's very interesting how the place names, some of them are very accurately represented in English, and some of them are just gobbledygook, as Barbara said. It's a good read if anyone was looking to delve more into it.
Okay, stay where you are. Greg, none of us have signed a contract with RTE, and we should not be paying for a station that is one-sided and doesn't give fairness to everyone and all repeats and rubbish, they say. RTE is running the company the same way the government are running the country. There is a flood of free cash which is being spent foolishly. No one's taking responsibility for it. And in the end, the average working man and woman who's paying highly will pay the price for this high, foolish spend. Fair play if you like Irish, but not everyone has the same graph for it. I went to an Irish speaking school from an English school at the age of 15. God, I had the worst teacher, so I had a terrible experience. Learning Irish in school is completely different to going to an Irish class in the evening. Learning Irish in school, it's basically shoved down your throat. And last one just before break, another scandalous payoff in RTE, 450k, when ordinary decent people are taken to court every week for not paying the TV licence. Two different laws for people in this country. Apparently, there is fury in Fianna Fáil over the decision to appoint Junior Minister Thomas Byrne as Director of Elections for the forthcoming referendums on the family and carers. Two Ministers of State, Anne Rabbitt and Mary Butler, were both overlooked for the position of overseeing the party's campaign for the removal of the controversial Women in the Home clause in the Constitution. But why should a man not be the Director of Elections on this issue? Or do you agree with those that believe it should have actually been a woman? Michael, step into this minefield with me.
I can't believe you asked me that question. You're bad. Absolutely so wrong. If the reason for it should be a man, well, number one, I really don't know what the referendum is about. I've kind of looked at it. The only articles I've read is Michael McDougall's article, and it was kind of, worryingly. But whether it should be a man or should be a woman, I honestly, at this stage, I would have to be honest and say, I don't see why it can't be a man. You know, it's, but then I'm speaking from a point of ignorance because I haven't studied in any great detail what the
referendum is. Well, I think really the question is, you know, I mean, you could argue, and it probably is the case, that these referendums primarily affect women, you know, and people say, well, then it should be a woman heading up the... But if we got to the point now, and that's the question, whereby really, you know, positive discrimination, or however one might frame it, and I'm open to correction on the terminology, so we need to move past that now, that of course, you know, men have an interest in women, in carers, being carers. Men are affected by this as well. I myself was on my own caring for my children for, you know, a long, long time, not really perhaps recognised in the Constitution. That's not an argument one way or other. But, you know, we as fellas have skin in the game as well.
No, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, like yourself, Greg, I was in a similar situation. It's tough. And I honestly can't say, I'll stick to my same answer. I don't see why it can't be a man.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's it, Catherine.
You know, there's a lot of men out there that were in the situation you were in it, I was in it. I raised my two teenage boys up to the adulthood on my own, and you get no recognition under the Constitution. So anyway, it's back to the two ladies from me anyway.
I suppose I'm somebody who's actually had experience, of being involved in a referendum campaign, and the Eighth Amendment, I chaired the parliamentary committee on that and was very involved in the subsequent referendum. And I would have welcomed more men to be involved in that conversation. There's a lack of male voices, and often you'd want more male voices. Now, again, Thomas Byrne is somebody I know personally, and I think he'd do a good job as director of elections. I think that it'll be hard to get people's attention on this referendum, because I don't think it's one that people feel hugely strongly about. But I would say I'm with Michael on this one. I don't see an issue with Thomas Byrne being the director of elections. I think he'll probably do a fine job.
Yeah, and the thing about these referendums as well, and Michael McDougall's comments were referenced in that, and when we actually start debating the ins and outs of it, and I think we start that on Monday, is that Michael McDougall's concerns is how the outcome might be, not the actual referendum itself, but how it might be interpreted or how it might be challenged or what it might lead to, it's difficult enough to get the conversation started, but really what the debate's going to be around, I think, is what doors this might open, what the consequences might be. It's going to be a tough one to debate, Catherine, I think.
I think so. And Michael McDougall is probably at a level of analysis of the potential change that most people won't engage in. In my experience, people tend to take a slightly more simplistic look at it. And, I heard Ronan Mullen, who I've batted swords with a good few times on other things, talking about it the other day on the radio. And he again had gone to a lot of places that, in all these scenarios that, to my mind, are quite unlikely to ever, be an eventuality. But
there are people in the last referendum that we had, there are people that argued that it will lead to a certain scenario that wasn't actually necessarily being voted on at the time, and they will feel vindicated in that position. So that's also going to be in the back of people's minds.
The back of their minds, yeah. I don't think an awful lot's going to turn on it, to be honest, in real terms. And I think the point made about raising your children on your own, and Michael as well, that's very valid. And carers need recognition, and it's no harm to have that recognition in the Constitution.
I'll bring Barbara in, Michael, but I think you wanted to just come back in there.
Yeah, the thing about it here, Greg, is what people fail to, some people tend to forget, is we are very, very lucky in this country in that we have a very neutral Supreme Court that can really adjudicate and have adjudicated on difficult problems like that. And a lot of the scaremongering that I've read, and Catherine says, we have safeguards in this country, to look after. So I wouldn't, I would agree with Catherine on that this is, but it'll definitely be difficult to engage people on this.
Barbara.
Whenever I saw this, I was a bit surprised, really, because to presume that there is a problem with this, to presume that the director of elections for a referendum on family and carers should be a woman, to my mind, is actually very sexist, because it's suggesting that men do not, as you say, don't have any skin in the game, aren't just as involved in terms of family and care. I think it's inherently sexist to presume that that role has to be taken by a woman. And I really would have... I wouldn't have any concerns about Thomas Byrne being the director of election of the referendum or the the process for this. But what I do have concerns about is that I think this referendum, the wording has a lack of clarity. I think they've rushed it through for some symbolic thing of having it on International Women's Day. I think it would have been better given it a bit more time, exploring the wording a bit more. I think, as Catherine says, I think the turnout for this one's going to be extremely low, because I don't think people really have engaged with this or maybe have explored the issues. And I think there are going to be people saying, this is so woolly that I don't actually know. Yes, I might think the Constitution needs to be changed, but I'm not sure about what this is actually going to do, what this wording is really going to mean. Mm. And so I think they've made a bit of a mess. I think who the director is the least of their worries. I think they should have waited. I think they should have spent more time. They should have wording.
The only thing I'd say with any referendum, it's really only the next few weeks where people will engage. You know, so if there's any chance, this is only really the start of it. I mean, he's just been appointed as director of elections. And the other thing, and it's just following on for something that Barbara said there, like in politics, what I found is women's issues, children's issues, all these types of issues were invariably addressed by women. And, you know, thank God a lot of us were there because, you know, the outcome might have been a bit different on some things. But it is actually a good thing to have a man lead on it in a sense. And I totally agree with Barbara's comments there on that as well.
Mm-hmm. And also, too, the danger is it not, is that we as the public don't actually fully inform, especially when things are a little bit complicated, don't fully inform ourselves of all the different ins and outs. Because what happens is now is, I think an awful lot of people have a go-to person that they see as an authority on something. So it could be your Ronan Mullins or it could be whomever it might be. It could be Aintu, it could be Fianna Fáil, it could be Fine Gael. And you go, right, I don't really get this, so I'm going to sort of go with what this person believes.
Or it can be an opportunity to give the government a lashing because they're looking to pass the referendum. Obviously, they're the ones proposing it. So if it fails, it's bad for the government. So simplistically, some people just decide they'll give the government a hammering.
Now, you know, also, I'm not sure. And in terms of, I suppose, it's how we adhere to or interpret or whatever our responsibility to Europe, Michael. The majority of people that contact this show, and I do understand it's a small amount of people contact radio shows, that's just a fact. Whether it's local or national, it's in the single digit percentages. And it's often those most motivated to do so when their views. But a lot of people really want a referendum on immigration. They're not, you know, they're not interested, it seems, in great numbers about this. They want referenda on the big issues of the day. And listen, a lot of the elections over the next year or two are going to be fought basically probably on issues like immigration and the issues that surround that.
I think the argument on immigration, it's okay, saying that is a national issue, but it's an European issue. Like we are part of the European Union, and an awful lot of our legislation comes from the laws that are based on European law. So, you know, the government's hands, whichever government is in power, their hands are going to be tied by legislation that is drafted in Brussels. And Ireland, we just can't go on a solo run on this. We just can't.
Yeah, but there are opt-outs
But it is difficult. You know, it is difficult. Like, this legislation is, you know, it is there in Europe. And it probably is something, and I know it is on the European agenda. Certainly, it's just not Ireland, you know, that is having a problem with this. But it is something that the European Union is going to have to revisit. Mm. You know, how I don't know whether Schengen has worked. You know, whether Schengen, as you know, with the free crossing the borders. I know Ireland's not a member of it, but around Europe, I don't know whether the Schengen experiment has worked in Europe, and certainly from a European level, mm-hmm. that immigration is certainly it is going to have to be revisited.
But I do think it's quite interesting that a lot of the language that was, you know, derided a couple of years ago is now actually being used in the Dáil and in parliaments around Europe. So things seem to be changing. The conversation seems to be switching. I'm going to take a break. Either of the two, you want to come back in on that, Catherine or Barbara, are you happy enough for me to go to the break?
Happy enough, yeah.
All right, back shortly. Danny says, good morning, Greg. I think the €160 is good value for the sport alone on RTE. Just a pity they can't run the company properly. Another, remember the promises that abortion would be rare. Now we're heading towards 50,000 terminations by the end of 2024. Wouldn't believe a word the chattering classes say. I kind of half referenced that a little earlier on. Catherine, do you take that caller's point? I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but argument...
I don't believe a word that what says.
It says the chattering classes. That's not a reference to use. It's just, classes. Yeah, no. Yeah. But,
I mean, listen. you know, I didn't necessarily want to bring the abortion issue onto your radio program this morning, but you know, the numbers weren't being recorded. It wasn't happening in the country. We allowed it in the country, but people had to get on a plane and go to a different country to have it carried out. So, you know, there are numbers now, and there always were, you know, and that's the reality. And people, women are being treated with more dignity and respect than they were before.
A caller says the referendum will allow immigrants to bring aunts, uncles, cousins to join them in Ireland. If that's what you want, vote yes. Barbara, I mean, I think, you know, people obviously, I think Michael McDougall suggested something.
That's a very confused person.
Has to be a woman in charge. Why not go the full hog and only allow women to vote? Well, I don't think there's anyone on this call actually has an issue with a fella being the head of elections. Ivan Yates is a poor man's Piers Morgan. You could say Piers Morgan's a poor man's Ivan Yates. I think Ivan does it better than Piers, but anyway. But unfortunately, the Irish language will never be spoken again as an everyday way of living, but it is our heritage and should be protected. Is that reality, Barbara? I mean, you know, over generations, things change and countries change, and the direction of traffic may not always be the same. Is it possible that Ireland will be spoken as an everyday language? Catherine doesn't agree. In the future.
But the thing is, there are so many people living in this country for whom Irish is their language of everyday life.
Yeah.
So it's not in any way true to say that that's some point in the future. I mean, my daughter's living in Belfast, and everything she does in terms of her work, in terms of the GAA team she plays with, in terms of her social life, is all through Irish in the Gaeltacht area of West Belfast. If you look at, you know, the Gaeltacht areas around this country, if you look at my work day to day, yes, at the moment I'm speaking English to you because...
That's my fault, not yours.
But, you know, people are speaking Irish as a reality of daily life throughout this country. And I think we need to respect the reality of that. Now, the chances of everybody in the country all speaking Irish all the time. No, I don't think that's realistic.
Yeah, nor is that of English anymore. If the, you know, which is not, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's having a go, but it is the truth. Barbara Cahill, thank you very much for your time. Really loved having you on the show as always. Have a lovely Friday and a lovely weekend. Also, Catherine Noon, great to have you on the show. Take care of yourself.
Thanks.
All right. And I didn't get a final word from you, Michael, after the last break, but it's always a pleasure. And thank you very much for your time today.
Take care, Greg.
Bye-bye, Slán. Okay, we'll be back with more after the news and obituary notices. Stay right where you are.